Welcome to the Baptist Joint Committee podcast. I'm Jordan Edwards, Communications Associate at the BJC. The 2016 Walter B. and K.W. Sheridan Lectures on Religious Liberty and Separation of Church and State were held April 4th and 5th on the campus of Bethel University in St. Paul, Minnesota. The lecturer this year was Dr. Molly T. Marshall, President of Central Baptist Theological Seminary in Shawnee, Kansas. Today we will be discussing the second of two lectures, and with me I have BJC Executive Director Brent Walker. Now, Brent, Dr. Marshall was a professor of yours in seminary. This is your last Sheridan lecture as Executive Director. Does it kind of feel like it came full circle? You had the, yeah.
I think so, yes. It felt right. She's quite a person, quite a scholar, quite a loyal friend.
The second of the two lectures focused on international religious liberty and protecting religious liberty for a Christian minority. In this case, she used her work in Myanmar, also known as Burma, during her lecture. Now, the BJC is mostly concentrated on domestic issues throughout its history, but the BJC has recently turned towards religious liberty around the world.
You're exactly right. The Baptist Joint Committee historically has focused in on domestic religious liberty, church-state issues. But yes, we're at a point now with our visioning process for the future, going to be more involved in international religious liberty issues. There's a sense in which it's a little bit artificial to differentiate between domestic and international. It's all religious liberty, and religious liberty abroad is in pretty bad shape. You know, real persecution around the world, not just of Christians, but of all religious minorities. So, you know, it deserves our attention as well as the more immediate issues here at home.
Yeah, and this was a really interesting lecture and really gives perspective on how nice it is to have religious liberty in the United States. I mean, and she talks about in the lecture that in Myanmar, if you want to change religions, you have to file with the government, which is insane to think about.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah, we in this country sometimes take our freedoms for granted, forget what it was like to have been a persecuted minority 400 years ago, 300 years ago in the case of a Baptist. So it's a good reminder that religious liberty is a precious right and is often denied to minorities. And so we don't have to look to history to learn that lesson. We can just look at contemporary life around the world.
Without further ado, let's listen to that lecture entitled Preserving Religious Liberty for a Christian Minority.
Well, good afternoon to all of you. It's lovely to be in your beautiful seminary. I was put on the planet to love seminary students, so I'm grateful to be in your midst. Now, we do have a saying at Central Seminary that might be applicable to some of you who are nearing the end of your time here. It is, salvation is by grace, but graduation is by works. You might want to remember that, although in my experience, usually there's some grace involved in all graduations. And so I wish you well as you wind up your semester's work. I've got some folk diligently grading papers. I was on a faculty meeting this morning by Zoom in which we were declaring the senior awards, and that's always a lot of fun to see who has done well in biblical studies and preaching, etc. So I wish you well, those of you who are for whom faith is becoming sight at this point. It's a delight to be with American Baptist colleagues and Baptist Joint Committee colleagues and faculty members here at the seminary, your fine dean and spouse. It's just a delight, and other guests and students. It's good to be with you all. I want to spend just a bit talking about preserving religious liberty for a Christian minority. Over the last 8 years, I have been back and forth from Myanmar a number of times because our school has a partnership with Myanmar Institute of Theology, a school founded in 1927, and with whom we had a partnership beginning after World War II, when there was so much destruction there, the bombing done by Japanese. We began to share in degree granting, and that went for a while, and then we renewed a partnership about 9 years ago and have a collaborative Doctor of Ministry program. And so I've been a little bit on a front row seat in these last few years as I have witnessed a remarkable shift going on. Now, not everybody knows where Myanmar, AKA Burma, is. In fact, I was once stopped at the MSP airport when they looked at my passport and said, now where is that? And I said where it was. You're not supposed to go there, are you? And I said, well, the U.S. Embassy issues visas. And so it was a young and eager young TSA agent, and I showed him a more excellent way in the words of the scripture. Here, of course, Myanmar, Burma, right next to Thailand, sharing a long border where most of the refugee camps are. And of course, India, to which the Judsons first came in 1813 and then came down and upstream into Yangon, what we used to call Rangoon. And the world is witnessing a remarkable transition of political power in Myanmar. You read something almost every day, don't you? This past November, the party of Aung San Suu Kyi, the National League for Democracy, won a landslide victory. And the election moves the country toward a more democratic rule after nearly half a century of brutal military control. And this party carries the hopes of millions in a country that has been beaten down by repressive rule. Now, the symbol of freedom in this country is the lady, as they call her, Aung San Suu Kyi, Nobel Prize winner, inspiration for her people. She has withstood 15 years of house arrest, been prevented from seeing her dying husband in England, lest she be barred from return, and most recently has been prevented from becoming the president of the nation. The military power wrote into the Constitution that if a person has family members holding foreign passports, as her two sons do, that person cannot serve as the head of the government. And she has ruefully stated, "They wrote that especially for me." Well, teaching there over these past several years and learning the stories of the Christian minority, I have become keenly interested in religious liberty in Myanmar. Recently, two civilians were nominated for president. That's a remarkable thing. The election was held on March 15, that's recent, for who was going to be president, and the news outlets televised the public counting of votes at the Capitol in Naypyidaw. Can you imagine? We should have done that in Florida a few years ago when there were hanging chads. They were counting. It was televised at the Capitol. Why? Because the last election was overturned by the military. And so this was a transparent thing to be counting the votes publicly. And when the military did that at the last election, the country was left with much despair, particularly those of ethnic origin. Now, let me give you a little bit of background on this emerging democracy. Burma, as it was formerly known, was part of the British Empire. This colonial power named it Burma because the majority ethnic group of the country is Burman, or Bama, as the locals call it. So they inherited a name by those who colonized their country. Yet when we refer to the approximately 60 million citizens of this country as Burmese, we are ignoring vast numbers of ethnic tribes. And let me have slide two, Brooke. Thank you. There are 8 major subgroups and about 135 dialects in the country. I'm very glad that Myanmar Institute of Theology teaches in English. And they don't just do it for their partners in North America, they do it because that would be a language, maybe the third language that their students know, but that would be a common language for them. And so when you look around the country, you're looking at Shan and Kachin and Chin, Rohingya, Kaya, Kayin, Mon, etc. 8 different ethnic groups. Those are primarily where the Christians reside, in those ring, those hills around the major plain, which is primarily Burmese. So 8 states, 7 townships comprise the Union of Myanmar. Missionaries from the United States arrived in 1813. The Judsons from Massachusetts, they were Congregationalists. When they went, they had enough time at sea to study their Greek and became committed Baptists. When you fly somewhere today, you don't have any time to make, you know, such radical decisions, but they had months to work on that. In the 16th and 17th century, there had been Roman Catholic missionaries there, but there was little success in engaging, much less converting, the Buddhist majority. As Adoniram Judson, that early missionary, is reputed to say, it's harder to convert a Buddhist than it is to extract the tooth of a tiger. Hard, hard duty. It was 6 years before a Buddhist was willing to break with his culture and family to become a Christian. But the hill people, those ethnic folk circling the major plain in the middle, nearly converted en masse. There were several reasons for this. Their traditional religion, animism, already had a belief in a supreme being, which Christian understandings could engage. And when the chief or the headman of a village converted, he would instruct the whole village to be baptized. It's just how you do it in that culture. And the cessation of fear of evil spirits, called the gnats, Christianity afforded a way to overcome some of that fear. Although they're still among the tribal villages, that a regnant fear of evil spirits. Even though many of these ethnic tribes are predominantly Christian, they still comprise only 7% of the total population of the nation. About 5 are Muslim, and 1% persist as animists. The rest of the nation is overwhelmingly Buddhist, and the nation holds to what is called a favored religion policy. And this means that Buddhists have special privileges denied to minority religions. There's a great challenge then for religious liberty. In September 2015, 4 laws known as the Race and Religion Protection Laws were adopted by the parliament. Now get the timing. September 2015. National elections, November 2015. New folk installed just this past week. So let me tell you about these 4 laws which tell you some of the challenge for the Christian minority. First, there is the monogamy law that makes it a criminal offense to have more than one spouse or live with an unmarried partner who is not a spouse. Some members of the Muslim minority reportedly practice polygamy, but the government has denied that the new law targeted Muslims. That's the first, the monogamy law. There's also, it makes it harder for Muslims who are not polygamous, who may not have clerical services even to get married. And so it's targeted toward them. Secondly, the religious conversion law. And this requires that a Myanmar citizen who wishes to change his or her religion must obtain approval from a newly established registration board for religious conversion, which has been set up in each of the townships. The person must go and undergo an interview, often ask humiliating questions, required to engage in religious study of the preferred religion, not to exceed 90 days from the date of application, and the process can be protracted on technicalities. If one still wishes to convert, the board will issue a certificate of religious conversion, but one is wearing somewhat of a scarlet A at that point, having gone through that out of one's neighborhood. Third, the interfaith marriage law regulates the marriages of Buddhist women to non-Buddhist men. If a woman is under 20 years of age, she must have parental consent. If she is older than that, the law allows local registrars to publicly post a marriage application for 14 days to determine whether or not there are any objections to the proposed union. And a couple may get married only if there are no objections. Men, I might add, do not have this same restriction. The fourth law, and this is the most confusing of this preservation of favored race and religion law. The fourth law is on population control, and they're stepping toward this a little more tenderly, given this huge and failed experiment in China. This law imposes on women in certain regions. Where do you think? In certain regions, to space the birth of their children 36 months apart. This seems to be a clear attempt to control the reproduction of Muslim and Christian minorities. It's the most confusing of the four laws, and they have not figured out how they are actually going to enforce it, but it is on the books. Now, the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom has stated that these laws on, that the law in particular on religious conversion should have no place in the 21st century. Knox Thames, who is the Director of Policy and Research at the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom, has said that the Burmese conversion law was a significant step backwards at a time when Myanmar should be looking for ways to correct existing violations by granting full civil rights to its religious minorities. And thus, the State Department lists Myanmar, they still call it Burma, because not all the sanctions are lifted, and Myanmar was imposed as a name on the military by the military regime, even though it has a more ancient and more appropriate naming of the people. The United States Department lists Burma as a country of particular concern in respect to religious liberty, which may be subject to American sanctions. You can find that in the State Department literature. Now, interestingly, before the Parliament passed these four laws for the preservation of race and religion, only a couple of months prior to the recent election, the Buddhist generals asked for response from minority religions. Some of my friends who are leaders of Myanmar Institute of Theology or the Pokhran Seminary, etc., wrote briefs, wrote letters, etc., but they felt like they had no sway, that their input, even though sought, was ignored. And this is the precarious position a religious minority experiences in Myanmar. When a Christian congregation or seminary wishes to construct a building, it must petition the government for a permit and then wait years for it to be issued. If they do not build the approved building, this is worse than zoning laws, President Jay. If they do not build the approved building in the specified time, the government may revoke the permit. So if you've not done your capital campaign just right, you may be out of luck given this kind of heavy-handed governmental piece. And sometimes there is ironic timing. The government approved the building permit for Myanmar Institute of Theology on Christmas Eve, which was a mocking reminder of who is really in charge. Well, that was prior to the most recent election. We don't know what's going to happen in terms of this kind of practice with a new government in place. Further, in this time of heightened Buddhist radicalism, can you get your mind around putting that in the same sentence? Buddhist radicalism? But we know that that's why so many of the Muslims are suffering in the Rakhine state, the Rohingya people who are primarily Buddhist. But in this time of heightened Buddhist radicalism, there have been instances of crosses being torn from churches. In addition, Buddhists may erect shrines just adjacent to church buildings and amplify chants so loudly that Christian worship is hindered, particularly when many of the churches in the villages are open air. It's just a roof and some poles. And so if you've got amplified chanting next door, it's hard. Preaching can occur only within the church building. If you were to take it to the marketplace, you would be in trouble as well, given a favored religion. Buddhism views Christianity as a form of Western colonialism and would prefer it not take root in the nation. Now I pause for a moment. In what way has a Christian mission also been on the same boat with colonial pursuits? Actually, too often. And the decimation of culture that has often occurred makes it understandable why there would be the pushback, as the gospel has not taken root in the natural soil enough of the country. Another challenge for ethnic Christian minorities is whether or not to fight for the freedom of self-determination. Let's go to the third slide here, Brooke. Thank you. Here is the border between Myanmar and Thailand. These are refugee camps. These are all on the Thai side of the border. There are families who have been there maybe into their third generation. They've not been able to get the papers. They've not been able to get the resources to make a transition to another part of the world. NGOs support these refugee camps. Primarily, these are Karen, who have been more protesting than others. You know, there's a very large Karen community here in St. Paul. I've not figured out why they left the steamy jungles to the snowy north, but they came. And religious liberty matters a whole lot. But the challenge then for ethnic Christian minorities, many of whom are Baptist, is whether or not to fight for the freedom of self-determination in their respective states, like Kaya, Cayenne, and if you go on up, Shan and Kachin states. Should a Christian wage war to preserve land and identity? It's a real question. I remember one of Central's doctoral students, a Kachin pastor named Balknaw, struggling with his Baptist convention's sanction of war, the Kachin Baptist Convention. He believed he should lead his congregation to pray for their enemies in the spirit of Jesus. He was thought to be somewhat suspect by that decision. His Baptist convention was urging young men to sign up for their regional army to defend their homeland, lest they become internally displaced persons that then can become a refugee as they're pushed over into Thailand. Children born there don't belong anywhere. They don't have papers. And so the difficult challenge, and there are literally tens of thousands of people in these refugee camps. Now, they are very industrious folk. There is a Bible college in almost every one of these camps. But the people live very close together, no privacy, not much self-determination. It's very hard. As some of the scholars say, we used to export rice, now we export people. Speaking of those leaving Myanmar. The military regime has systematically driven people from their land into these refugee camps, and neither Myanmar nor Thailand will claim them. They live only with ethnic and not national identity. And such an existence adds to the difficulty then of being resettled in another country. Many of the refugees who have made their way to the U.S. spent decades in a camp prior to coming here. Our school has been doing some educational projects with resettled folk, and you know what they want to study, what their pastors want help in? Post-traumatic stress disorder, because they have all experienced the indignities of being displaced and have suffered. Well, let's return with this background in mind to the game-changing recent election. I pray it's game-changing. As the informal leader of her party, Aung San Suu Kyi nominated two persons for the presidency. The military got to nominate the other one, and he was not elected, interestingly. She nominated two. One was named Chin Chaw, a fiercely loyal confidant who is also Buddhist, former schoolmate of Ms. Suu Kyi, and he stood at her side when she was released from house arrest in 2010. The National League for Democracy, also her party, nominated an ethnic Chin member of parliament named Henry Van Thu, a law graduate and a Christian, nominated for president. Well, I was there as they were talking about, can we possibly elect a Christian in a land with a preferred religion with these laws on the books? Well, he was not elected. He is the second vice president. There were enough votes for that. But even this was too much for those who believe Christianity should have little religious freedom in the land. Others are more optimistic, think his presence will spark new openness toward the Christian minority. One of our doctoral students was so bold as to say, maybe he can evangelize the parliament. Well, we'll see. 25% of the parliament is appointed, not elected, appointed by the army. Ethnic rebel groups still locked in conflict with Myanmar's military are eager to broker peace with the new civilian president. And it will be his urgent task to tackle the country's long-running insurgencies as he takes office at the end of March, which this last Friday he took office, concluding an extended power handoff from the outgoing army-backed government from November till just this past week. Now, one of the new government's toughest tasks will be snuffing out the civil wars that regularly flare between the National Army and a patchwork of these militias or federated regional armies, patchwork of them, in the resource-rich borderlands. And you've read enough to know that Myanmar is being pressed by India, pressed by China, pressed by Thailand in places because they have minerals, they did have forests, they have water resources, and everybody wants a piece there, very little of which is benefiting the local folk. A recent surge of violence in the northern Shan state, why don't you go back to number two, which has hosted multiple rebellions over the decades, has displaced more than 6,000 people since early February from the Shan state over into Thailand. This is according to the UN's Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. The new government has offered hope, not only for ethnic people, but for the whole nation. It is an elected government. They know the people's wishes, a commentator recently said, adding that the outgoing administration, led by retired army generals turned politicians, had failed to bring the peace it promised. But the military force of Myanmar is far from spent, because the Constitution ensures that it retains significant power, 25% of the votes. The military will retain a vice president and control of three crucial ministries, home, defense, and border affairs. Those are the ones they assigned to the, those three to the 14 new ministers of the different divisions. Aung San Suu Kyi has four herself, among them foreign affairs, which is the one she desired. Well, in this time of unprecedented political transition, I'm eager to learn how the new government will deal with the ongoing contraction of religious liberty for Muslims and Christians. Outsiders and cautious insiders have criticized Aung San Suu Kyi for her tepid reaction to the brutal treatment of Muslims by radicalized Buddhist leaders. You know, a huge humanitarian disaster is looming there. People find it easier to get on a boat and hopefully sail on down to Malaysia, but they end up being killed or trafficked or sold or somehow enslaved. But they are living in desperate circumstances in tent cities there. And Aung San Suu Kyi didn't say a lot about it. Some have suggested she was biding her time until the conclusion of the November elections and the handover of power to the democratically elected leaders. Now that this has occurred, what might Christians in Myanmar expect? And here, like a good Baptist, I'm going to draw back to Roger Williams' view of religious liberty, which Baptists in Myanmar know well. He could be described as the father of political pluralism in the words of Miroslav Volf in his new book, Flourishing. Here's the contribution. After being banished from the Massachusetts Bay Colony for what were deemed to be heretical and seditious views about religious liberty and for defending the rights of Native Americans, he went on to found Rhode Island and create the first government in the world, which broke church and state apart. In a 400-page book titled The Bloody Tenet of Persecution for the Cause of Conscience, I hope you've all read it. If not, do so before the day is over. I can only assign books at my place. Nice try. He explained his rigorous stance on religious liberty. I quote, written in 1644, "It is the will and the command of God that since the coming of his Son, the Lord Jesus, a permission of the most paganish, Jewish, Turkish, or anti-Christian consciences and worships be granted in all nations and countries. And they are only to be fought with that sword which is only in soul matters able to conquer, with the sword of God's Spirit, the Word of God." That's his admonition. Well, in all of American history, no one has argued for such radical freedom of conscience. And Baptist students in seminary are reading what he said. It'll be interesting what they can do with it. Williams fashions this perspective out of his grounding conviction that all human beings are equal before God, and forced worship stinks in God's nostrils, and I quote. Work that into your next sermon. Well, what is the recourse then for Christians in Myanmar? Some are cautiously optimistic after the elections, yet equal religious liberty seems imperiled by the recent legislation. If I were a pastor in a village, I think it'd be really hard working with this conversion law. I think it's important, however, that we in the U.S. stand up for religious liberty there as well as here. In its 2014 report, the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom noted that political reforms in Burma have not improved legal protections for religious freedom, and have actually gotten worse, and have done little to curtail anti-Muslim violence, incitement, and discrimination, particularly targeting the Rohingya Muslim minority. And then the report went on to indicate that state-sponsored discrimination and state-condoned violence against Muslim minorities and ethnic minority Christians faced serious abuses during recent military incursions in Kachin and Shan states. Well, there's been a response. One response has come from the Board of General Ministries of the American Baptist Churches USA at its June 2014 meeting, which occurred in Kansas, I might add. The General Board voted to support legislation currently being considered in Congress, Senate Bill 1885, House of Representatives Bill 4377, that would require advance in human rights and religious liberty by the government of Burma as a condition of security assistance. To the best of my knowledge, and you may know better, Brent, one initiative died in the House and the other was referred to a Senate Committee of Foreign Affairs, and that's where it sits at this point. So why not try to get the ear concerning those who could restart reflection on this? Christians in Myanmar are coming out of the political shadows and are being more vocal in their call for religious liberty. They are voting, writing, calling for change, feeling empowered, and urgently petitioning the new government to lessen the iron grip that the preferred religion has on the land. Their experience as a Christian minority has honed their faith, and they are forthright in protesting their treatment. They're not as voiceless as once they were. Baptists have made religious liberty a hallmark of our faith, and it matters that we stand with other Baptists, especially those in Myanmar who face severe constriction of free exercise. In these lectures, I have stressed that our understandings of religious liberty must acknowledge that we live in a religiously plural world. And in yesterday's lecture, I argued that if you're going to be a religious exclusivist, you need to be a political pluralist if you would stand for the religious liberty of all. I've argued that we are witnessing a significant time of reorientation as Christians think theologically about the religious other. And now I've pointed to the real discrimination that Christians face in Myanmar and invite us to stand with them for religious liberty. For we know that what we enjoy here, given our constitution and heritage of religious freedom, matters for others as well. Thank you.
That was Dr. Molly T. Marshall delivering the second of two Sheridan Lectures at Bethel University in St. Paul, Minnesota. Thank you for listening to the Baptist Joint Committee podcast. For more podcasts, visit our podcast page at bjconline.org/podcasts or subscribe to our iTunes channel.